Hello, and welcome to Theatre Voice for another season finale. It has undoubtedly been one of the landmark productions of the year, perhaps even of the entire decade. Marianne Elliott's revelatory revival of Death of a Salesman asked what life might have looked like for an African-American Lohman family. Arthur Miller's Every Clan was transformed in a shot. Wendell Pierce's Willie Lohman, a towering performance if ever there was one, became not a failure, but a man who couldn't see his own success. He was a black man locked out of a white dream, and he blamed himself. Next to him, as his wife Linda, Sharon D. Clarke found extra reserves of stoical strength and tragic realism as he plodded on. His sons changed too. Rather than dropping out, Sope Desaru's Biff opts out after being edged out. Natey Jones's Happy seemed like a smart kid gone to seed, having inherited his father's vices. That astonishing cast sat down with Theatre Voice's founder Dominic Cavendish earlier this month to talk through an extraordinary interpretation of an extraordinary play, Death of a Salesman.
When I interviewed Marianne Elliott before, I said to her, you know, because she loves to talk a little bit about doubt and how she's not sure whether she's good enough to do such a thing. And she said, crucially, that she'd sent you maybe an email saying, you know, I'm not sure whether I should go ahead with this. What do you think? And that she'd implied that you'd sent almost a kind of one sentence reply. Maybe this is completely mythologized, saying you've got to go for it. And I don't know, was that, it seems that you're very instrumental in encouraging it.
I think it was in person, you know. Yeah. She was telling me, you know, the concerns that she had and the pushback that she had gotten. She'd gotten pushback from, she had done a read through and these actors all said that, oh, you can't do this. And they were going through a litany of problems that they had with the interpretation. And I said to her, I said, Marianne, I said, that's the very reason you should do it. Mm-hmm. I said, you have to do it. And she said, who am I, this white woman from Britain? I said, well, if that's the case, then what? I can't direct, you know, Three Sisters because I'm not a white Russian woman originally. So I said, I'll fight all of those battles with you. I said, but you got to do it. And I think that became the mantra, you've got to do it. I would have never thought I was going to be a part of it. It was something that all of my insecurities about it was, I had never even considered the play. Mm. Considered it might be someone, a play that I would be asked to do. So it's not only his story here, the interpretation has never been done in the States because they go even further because they make our neighbors, they make almost everybody in the play black. So this doesn't have the resonance then, you know. And there are people who've had reactions to our interpretation, negative reactions, not even realize that we've done the research. You know, this is coming out of a place that is true and authentic. You know, and everything. I have friends in from Brooklyn, and they were talking about Erasmus. Mm. You know, they were just like, that is exactly the high school Biff would have been playing at and all. So her being able to do this, I said, you have to be able to do it. You know, you have to do it, and I'll fight all those battles with you when it comes to any pushback.
So in some ways, it's arguing the case for this sort of interpretation to become maybe more standardized even in the States. Because I know that famously, and some reviewers mentioned this, August Wilson said that it would be inconceivable to do it in this way because he assumed that Willie Lohman would be almost lynched had he tried to be a salesman at this particular point in American history. So maybe he hadn't fully appreciated there were these avenues. Is that right?
Yes. He hadn't appreciated all the avenues. I actually knew August and, you know, actually produced Jitney and Radio Golf. Jitney off Broadway, Radio Golf on Broadway. And so I know he had very particular views. I actually know, you know, and it's not something that's not unknown to in the community. Some people say, oh, you shouldn't do that, and we shouldn't have to, you know, be beholden at interpreting white playwrights' plays and give us validity. But I disagreed with him. as we all can have disagreements. And this interpretation actually speaks to our humanity, and it actually works in concert with the player, not in competition to the themes. So it heightens it. I look forward to this production being done in America. This particular production, I'm just put that out there.
I think it makes a difference as well that it's not colorblind casting throughout. I think if it had been an all black cast, then you lose it again because mm-hmm. you don't have the levels of subtlety and what was happening with regards to race and all of everything that happened in that time. If it's an all black cast, you just don't have those subtle nuances. But when you do it in this way, I think you heighten the text. We haven't changed a word. And everything just makes much more sense, is deeper. I mean, like when you're in the hotel room with the woman, you say, I think there's a law about it in Massachusetts.
Yeah,
that line rings, pings out even more because you do have this interracial couple.
When Happy is taken into
the back room
in the restaurant, though you'd be a lot more comfortable back here. It is seen as a special room for the Loman brothers, and other interpretations. You see the sense of segregation immediately mm-hmm. in this production.
It's interesting, a lot of people have said that even though they studied the play or may have had an interaction with the play before in the past, seeing it now, they're actually surprised that the play wasn't originally written with this racial makeup. Mm. That instances such as when we first see Bernard on stage, the first white person to speak in the play, and Willie Loman calls him anemic. And the amount of time the word boy comes out and is used to needle and pin the person who they're speaking to, and the racial connotations of the word boy.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost as if some of the richness of the text is lost when it is not in the makeup that it is at the moment. So not only does it heighten it, but it just
deepens it and makes it richer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I suppose I'll just to rewind a second. I mean, talking about it as a kind of almost like a canonical white American play, these were not going to be parts you were necessarily going to be offered. And I just wondered whether it was a play that had resonated for you before, whether you'd read it and this was a play that mattered for you or not so much.
Yeah, it definitely resonated for me. I saw Dustin Hoffman's television version. I saw Brian Dennehy in person. I saw Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
Just studied the play in school. It always resonated to me. It was a complicated play. It challenges you just in its makeup, just as a piece of as a study. You know, as a dramaturg, as storytelling, and how do you get to that? So it was always something that I saw as essential in one of the great plays.
Yes, classic play, seminal play.
Yes, yes. So had you felt like, well, this shouldn't be out of bounds, you would have, at some point, would you have said, if somebody said, let's do, as it were, a kind of, as you said before, kind of colorblind casting, that would have appealed? Or did you think,
I would have asked for this interpretation. You know, I actually, in the discussions back and forth with Marion, there was a point where there was some discussion about whether or not the woman in the hotel would be white. I said, she has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she has to be white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we got into the discussions of the levels, the complexity of the betrayal. And mm-hmm. then the betrayal, not only the betrayal of a wife, but the betrayal of that sort of infidelity for black women. You know, I will never be a white woman. So it leadens it. And then also the danger that it puts me and my son in.
Mm-hmm.
That literally 300 people in Tulsa, Oklahoma were murdered because a white woman bumped into a black man on an elevator, and a race riot happened in Tulsa that killed 300 black folks because of just something as slight as that. Emmett Till whistles at a white woman in Mississippi and he is lynched and murdered and disfigured so much so that his mother says, leave the coffin open so that we can see this sort of murderous evilness that killed my son, and it sparked the modern day civil rights movement. I said, so that danger is something that we want to always have a part of this. It heightens everything.
It's interesting, actually, that you asked a question like, did it feel out of bounds because it was a white American play? To answer that, in my experience, I saw this play when Anthony Scher was playing Willie up at the RSC, and I aspired to the role of Biff. I didn't actually see any barrier, and I suppose that's the world in which we want to live, where we don't feel that anything is inaccessible to us because of the colour of our skin, or that any playwright or any story is inaccessible to us. Like, you want to be the best performer for that role. And it resonated with me greatly. I saw a lot of my own experience on stage, because it is a wonderful universal story about the working man. And I didn't see it as the working white man. Arthur Miller was a white man who wrote the play. Or even when I read it, it's one of the first instances of storytelling where I didn't not see myself in it. Because I think there is a real problem with education in this country, in many countries, where there's something that we need to cure in the way we educate and raise our children about their own visibility within stories, period, and art.
Yeah.
And this was one of those plays where I saw, like, no, I need to play that role. I feel like I've got a connection to that role. And it was only a couple of years later that we're here. But also, no, I did not feel, and I want to engender that in all of the generations to come, that they should never feel like they can't perform a certain role because of the colour of their skin.
The fact that it was unexpected to me is really a commentary on the lack of vision with those who produce commercial theatre or even regional theatre.
Produce and cast.
And cast, you know, that they would never do it. I actually was told, coming out of drama school, the casting director told me, well, you know, I couldn't put you in a Shakespeare movie or something like that, because they didn't have black people back then. Yeah. The literal words that came out of his mouth, they didn't have black people back then. I was about to say, tell a couple of my folks who were on a plantation.
I was going to say, I was very touched by your interview on Desert Island Discs and the sense, when you talked about your father, that he was a man who served his country loyally and to the death almost, but was not treated well. And there seemed to be sort of these extraordinary affinities with Lohmann as he's rendered in this production, because he doesn't spell out the damage and the hurt done to him, but we feel it. And I don't know whether you feel in some ways it's a connecting point with you and your father.
I think of my father all the time, every night. I think of my father every night, because he's a man of such principle that he understands that he doesn't want you to fall victim to the fallibility of someone else. He would always preach, there are those who don't have your best interest at heart, but that should not affect what your journey is going to be about. And understand that you have to exercise your right of self-determination. And he stuck to that principle so much so that he didn't want me to be an actor. But he knew he couldn't get in my way, because he had always said, if you want to do something, commit yourself 100%. That's all I ask. I said, well, I'm committing myself to this. So even though I'm against it, I want you to go. But I know my father, like so many African Americans, they're patriotic because I think of the phrase, which is in music and poetry, what America is to me. America to me is all of those faces, nameless people who gave their lives, who had a right to vote, who tried during enslavement to be, who were insurrectionists, who said, let's fight for our freedom. Let's, all of those who fought politically and legally to make sure their rights. So that's the sense, that's the pride that I feel when I think of myself as an American, that you had so many people that believed so much in what the document of the institutions of America that are documented in the Constitution, that they believe that there's so much possible in that American experiment, even though we are nowhere near it, that I'm willing to give in to the idea of true freedom and independence, and who've given their lives when there was no evidence that it was being practiced anywhere around them. They still believed in the idea and the ideal so much so that they felt as though that they can have an impact on society to move it forward. And I think of that Moses generation for me, my parents' generation, who have given me this baton as the Joshua generation to move forward. And from you, you will create a legacy that you've handed on to the next generation to try to move it forward. And ultimately, I believe that that sort of the thing that my father has that Willie doesn't, and she says it, you have it all right here. Okay. Yeah, yeah, right before the line. It's well enough. You're living well enough.
You're doing well enough.
You're doing well enough. You have your boys and they love you. That Willie can't see it, but my father did. Because my father said, I'll never leave my children. He had an estrangement with his father, but he said, if I ever had kids, I would never leave them. And he understood that the richness of his life was right there and family. So I think of him every night.
All productions always bring one to tears, I think, of Death of a Salesman. But there is that feeling that sometimes his lostness in the dream that he hasn't attained, we mistake it for a certain kind of naivety. And here it's the dignity, as you just said, almost that he's cleaving to an idea in the face of reality. And so it's not a kind of madness. It's a kind of fidelity. It's a sort of strength. And I think that comes across very strongly.
And ultimately that fidelity, he makes the wrong choice. He can give him something, right? And not have him hate. He actually says it. Just let go of that dream. Just let go of that dream. That would be the gift.
And see me as I am.
And see me as I am. But Willie makes the mistake that his choice is going to be the gift. But it comes from that fidelity of saying, I want to give him something. I want to give him something. I want to give her something.
You see, it's concrete.
It's concrete. I'm going to plant a garden, you know?
Yes.
I just offer him a chance to go to sleep. Go to sleep, man. Mm-hmm. You know? I've provided for you. And Willie, at every turn, fights. And that's what we have. That's what I have in common with my father as I play the role, you know? At every turn, fight, no matter what. And he loses his way. He loses his way when he can't see the forest for the trees, the love that is around him, you know? And
brilliantly put. I mean, I suppose it's so complicated, isn't it? Because all of you have these contradictory emotions that you want to support and love this man who's in pain, but part of helping him might be to tell him the hard facts, the truth that he's sort of denying himself. And in a way, I suppose the pressure, there seems to be this flow of pressure that Linda has to withhold herself so much, and she can't say the things that perhaps some wives would say.
But I think there is that fear as well of pushing him over the edge, you know what I mean? That feeling of trying to contain what is there, what is the essence of the man, so that he doesn't lose himself to push himself to where he ultimately goes. And that's what she's trying to stop, you know what I mean? The choice that he ultimately makes. Because we, within the show, we're looking at him spending that last year trying to find different ways of ending his life and pushing himself over the edge. And she's been dealing with that and trying to contain that. So when we get to the play, it's the night before his death where she's only just finally telling the boys. So she's tried to hold on to that and hold on to him for as long as possible.
I think Sharon has exhibited something that is so culturally significant, was the strength of black women within the family, understanding all of the pressures that black men facing a society that is so aggressively against them when they walk out the door, of the nuance, of the balance, of when to support, when to challenge, when to soothe, when to get out of the way. There has been historically a traditional way of playing Linda as the meek wife who, I just don't know how to help Willie. When in this world, when I feel in the portrayal of Sharon D. Clarke's Linda, is that she's holding everything together with these men who are spiraling, and it's spiraling in all the pressures that are hitting them societally every day. When he talks about, I want to fight all those, you know, managers right in the stores with everything he's talking about, he's saying, I just want the freedom to be able to enjoy the spring day in Texas, especially, you know, and then everything that Willie's going through, and it's Linda that's holding this family together within this whirlwind. That's educating all of us. If you look at how she interacts with everyone, she's educating one about the other. Your father, your father, your father. You have sons that love you, that respect you. That she's trying to
see educate. What's there.
And she is such a stalwart. That's why it just rings out at the end. all things for you to do, Willie, right now. Because now we have gotten to the place that we're free. We're free. And the idea, the concept of freedom for African Americans is the most cherished thing in the world at all times. Because we actually came out of the denial of that, the idea of freedom. And that just rings out at the end of the play.
Yes.
But her portrayal of Linda, I think, traditionally has changed the portrayal of the role forever.
Your patience and your sympathy with it, Willie, is pushed quite a lot, because, you know, in this day and age, particularly, to see a husband tell a wife to sort of be quiet when he's saying something, that sense of ownership a little bit, she has the strength almost to sort of take it on. And so there's this feeling that you learn more and more about her, even though she doesn't declare why she's doing what she's doing, I suppose. But I mean, do you find that? It's not an underwritten role, and yet you're given that you have to put a lot into very little, I suppose. Is that a sort of challenge? Whereas Willie has quite long speeches, Linda doesn't.
Oscar Wilde's not known for writing well for women. One of the things for me is that I didn't want Linda to come across as feeling afraid of Willie, which is what I've sometimes felt when I've seen it, that she's a little bit wary of him. And I wanted people to see that she wasn't afraid of him, she was afraid for him, which is a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. And so when in that state, then you have to find a strength that garners and upholds and makes your man sore and your family sore. And so I wanted her to be strong. I didn't want her to be this meek standing in the background. So she needs to cuss her family, then she cusses it. And she may cuss Willie in private, not in front of the boys, but it has to be done. That's what women do. I think a lot of it is drawn from my mum, who would have been that kind of woman who'd have just been more outspoken. I mean, the only thing with my mum is the first time Willie told her to shut up, she'd have told him about himself. It's the difference. But it's having to have that strength for the family. Wendell said before about being emasculated when you step outside the door. Having that sense of, I don't know, being a king in your own castle.
And it's such and I suppose the design is so beautiful because it's partly an interior reflection of his mindset, but also so vulnerable. There isn't really a cocoon where he can retreat to and thrive. It's too exposed, it's too hemmed in. I know it's quite interesting talking about the brother's sort of psychology, but I suppose the thing the production really brings out is also a kind of physicality, really demanding these flashback sequences where you are almost like in a sort of sped up version of how the past was, and you have to perform these heroic feats in double quick time. I mean, it looks pretty challenging to an outsider, getting those cues so fast and so correct.
I mean, that's definitely one of the departments in which Miranda, as a co-director, came to the fore. I think movement and the musicality of the piece were very important to her, that style, yeah. We were drilled over and over to make sure that, especially the glitches, the famous glitches, were performed as accurately as we possibly could. But I don't know. I suppose, like, because I've got a very physical background in terms of the sport I played from a young age, I was never daunted by the physicality of A, the role, and B, the production. It's something that I suppose I kind of like really enjoy, and that discipline of the part is quite fun. And then like rehearsing and working with Nate, especially because we were about a similar size and build, meant that like we were able to not need to be too careful with each other. Especially in rehearsal, like we're both very robust, so we could push each other, we could really fight as young boys would have done. And it's interesting to see how that physical journey and physical relationship between the two of them is the stark differences between them as boys and then them as adults and being slightly estranged from one another. But to answer your question, I don't think actually the physicality of the boys at their young age is the most draining part of the show at all.
It's funny that you talk about rehearsals, because I forget that the week that we spent doing so much physical language with each other, and thinking back then, it was quite a task to keep that up every single day. It was really joyful. We played music when we did it, but now it's such second nature. And actually, I don't really feel like I'm performing in the flashback scenes. They feel really natural, and it feels so joyous. It's those moments where we herald Willie and praise him as our hero, and because it's so joyful, when we come back to present day, that's what makes the dark moments so painful, because those moments are so fulfilled and so energized and real that it makes the latter moments of the play so painful, because his fall from grace is so extreme.
In a way, because you came and there was this kind of, there's this prior production at the prior incarnation at the Young Vic. How did you kind of form these sort of, I don't know how maybe that just happens naturally in rehearsals. Is there a particular knack of getting a family bond that's fit, because it feels so tight on stage?
The one thing I wanted to do was to make sure that I found something in all the actors that I play with. You know, and especially getting that family bond. You start with the people that you have, you know, and I actually talk about this with my girlfriend in the evening. I say, oh, you know, Sophie this, and, you know, and Nadia this, and Sharon this. And it's just like, oh, I just talk about them as people first.
Mm.
And there's so much that you fall in love with the actual actors, that I actually didn't start to consider about how far London is from America until I'm like, man, when this is over, it's not like I could just call folks and, hey, man, let's get together for dinner or whatever.
Yes.
I found that to be the easiest part. There's so much in their humanity that I just love. There's so much there of humanity. And especially...
And respect.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Respect and admire the work ethic. There's wonderful, wonderful performers. As people, oh my God, love them.
Mm.
Love them. It's very easy to love this family.
Yeah.
It's not been hard work at all. It hasn't been, all right then, how can we make this connection? Mm. How can we make this feel real? What do we have to do? It's just been really organic and really natural.
And I've seen so many actors make the mistake. I mean, so I just never understood how actors could be so aggressive towards each other. You know, just aggressive towards each other. You know, it's like characters are competing, but they miss the opportunity of another actor is going to give you something. They are literally something you hadn't even thought about. And so many actors say, why is he doing that? Because I wanted to go down this way, and he's doing that. You know?
Then you have to work with that, because that's life.
Right.
Yeah. In life, you can't say to someone, actually, you know what? You just have to get on with it. Lovely when someone gives you something different to work with.
There's a great sort of musicality in this production, and in some ways, I suppose it has got this jazz feel to it. That there are sounds are floating in the air, and there's a kind of dreaminess to it. That's really brought out in the music. And then speech suddenly turns into song, and it's as though he's lost in. Something is claiming him from the past, you know, which is a different cultural moment, I suppose. I don't know, was that something that Maren Elliott had in her mind at the beginning and said, music's going to be really important, or did you want to bring that out? And...
No, it's very, very interesting, because people always bring that up. The music is written in the play. When you see the production, you know, the flute comes in and he leaves, and introductions of scenes, and you go out. But the musicality that we brought specifically to this makes people believe it's even more than is written.
Mm-hmm.
The musicality and just even, you know, the phrasing of speeches or different lines, whatever, because people... aren't accustomed to hearing it like that, you know. And I specifically think about the idea of what the American aesthetic is exemplified in jazz, which is you have a finite amount of notes, but you have an infinite amount of possibility when putting them together. That you have to keep order and structure of a song, the chords, the verses, but at the same time, within that, you have the freedom of improvisation. So it's that sense that we have, and especially this company, that we can play off of each other even further than people normally do in productions, because there's a sense of trust, there's a sense of understanding the musicality in the words, seeing where another actor is going to go, like in a really good jazz ensemble. Oh, he's going down that way. Well, I'll follow. Mm-hmm. Or he's going to hold back here. We, a sense of playing off of each other that way is honoring the structure and form of the scene and of the story and of the storytelling really makes it something that is uniquely the contribution to the human diaspora mm-hmm. from the African-American experience. That amalgam, that's adaptable within the confines of their situation. It's exemplified in our experience, and that's the contribution, and that's what I love about it the most, playing with this company of actors. It's the fact that there was a moment that happened when we came off stage where we had just had a really great hit. We were riffing, and it was swinging, you know, as we say in jazz. It was swinging.
Yeah.
It was in the pocket, it was in the groove, it was swinging. And I'm like, oh. It was actually coming out of the first fight between Biff and Willie. And I saw her backstage. I'm like, oh, let's get to the bedroom. I couldn't wait to get to, you know, the bedroom scene. It was just, and that was this, I think that's something that you want in every production. All great productions have that, but it's heightened in this production and is exemplary of the African-American experience. I think that's what our contribution has been to the human diaspora.
The poignancy that this is arriving at the end of the decade, I suppose that at the beginning of the decade, we're in the kind of Obama era, we're now in the sort of Trump era, and if you're a white British audience and you watch this production, you can go, oh, this is really fascinating, there is this period piece and it's been reinvigorated or reinterpreted, but maybe for African-American, Black, British, you're looking at this and going, but this is shocking, because when he puts this sort of pressure on his sons to go to college or to strike out and make a name for themselves and make a deal and all these things that the sons are going, but we don't think we can do this because we know the situation, we know that the doors are not going to open for us in the way that you're telling us. That I don't know whether people have told you watching this, whether it feels as though it's, or maybe you just feel it when you're playing it, it feels kind of topical, that there's this unfinished business of we may not be in a segregated society, but we're not in an equal one.
The specific interpretation appeals to everyone. The more specific you are, the more universal it becomes. It's an African-American experience, but it's all with the themes of what this play was about, and it speaks to everyone: white, Black, young, old, male,
immigrant,
female. And the experience I've gotten is people come back. And it's not like, oh, that's your experience and not mine. It has been totally a cathartic moment of, this is what's happening in my life. You spoke to me. You touched me and made me clearly see how to avoid the pitfalls and dysfunctions of what Willie goes through. How what's important is the love of family and touching family and not making the mistakes of allowing your individualism to be crushed by some capitalistic idea or some institutionalized idea or whatever. It's not, the more specific you are, the more universal your message becomes. So clearly you see what's happening with Willie as an African-American man at this time in 1949 and how it is destroying him and destroying the very richness and wealth that he has, which is his family, and destroys the relationships that go on beyond the family and later illuminates something for everyone, you know? And it's not restrictive, it's actually broadening, it's more broad. What is a reminder in this play is that it's not an era, it wasn't an Obama era and a Trump era, that it's one, you know, it is, and it's like a chronic disease. Will always be with us. The naivete is to believe that this ugliness of human nature, of racism, of sexism, you know, homophobia, all of that, is actually that we may one day evolve. And I think one day we may And I ultimately, I personally ultimately believe that we are on an upward curve, that humans are on an upward curve. But, you know, the cat who put his hand in fire a million years ago probably said, I thought, if he showed up today, I thought we'd be a little further along than this. Shit. But we have to, but it's a chronic disease, and we have to treat it as though. We have to be vigilant. The best thing about this era of this era now is that the veil was lifted to remind us of what was underneath all along. So the real disservice was the naivete of the past era of saying, oh, we're post-racial. We're past that now. That this is, when actually it was just one step towards where we ultimately want to go, but we had not reached it. We have not reached that place of human involvement. It resonates now because we realize that the barbarians are always at the gate, that ugliness in human nature that we have to fight against, and that we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility, and you have to be vigilant.
I know it's a very big question for all of you, but in a sense, do you feel more positive or optimistic about theatre as a place where these stories can be told? I mean, I know, you know, there's been Carolinal Change, there's been a number of shows that you guys have been involved in the West End as well. And it feels maybe as though it's becoming that theatre is, in the UK perhaps, particularly, is becoming more diverse. I mean, but does it feel as though it's moved on?
It slowly feels like it's moving on. But for me, the minute you have to still bring that question up, we're not there. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? When this question is no longer a part of the conversation, we're there.
Mm.
So yeah, there's still work to do. And it's nice that there is more stuff coming through. But there could always and should always and still needs to be more.
I know you had to sort of do, a temporary relocate because of the dramatic ceiling moment. And actually, you know, this is a production that just bounced straight back and sort of went back over the river. And I didn't see your scratch performance. But I mean, was that quite a heady few days to sort of realize that you were sort of temporarily unable to be based here, I suppose?
We weren't here for a couple of days, but we went back to the Young Vic and we did the show. And it was actually, for me, there were things that happened in the scratch performance that I preferred. I really liked the liberation of that, you know. Mm-hmm. No sets, no props, nothing, mm-hmm. just plain old-fashioned storytelling, mm-hmm. to the core.
Yeah, it was great.
And it was very liberating. And I think as actors, we found things within that performance that we've been able to bring back, mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. that we wouldn't have found had we still been here. So everything for a reason.
Yeah,
that's exactly what happened. It just got back to the core of what the play was.
Yeah.
And playing off each other. And, the play's the thing.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, for hundreds of interviews with the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Dominic Cavendish and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.